Coming to you from Linux World in San Francisco, California, this is Novell Open Audio. Welcome to Novell Open Audio, the podcast that connects the Novell user community to what's going on inside and around the Novell universe. I'm your host, Ted Hager.
And I'm Aaron Quill.
And we're here today at Linux World Expo doing a couple interviews. Yesterday we had Nat Friedman on the show, and today we've got Jeremy Allison back on the show. That's this gentleman right here.
Hello.
And what we're doing with our podcast from Linux World Expo is just taking a few of our people from Novell who are maintainers and leaders within the open source community and giving you a quick look at who the personalities are behind a lot of different things that happen within open source. And kind of a celebrity personality is who we have today. Jeremy Allison is, if I may just sing your laurels before we skewer you.
If you must.
the person we have here today, Jeremy Allison, maintains the Samba project and has been on it for quite a long time. In fact, he's been working in Linux for just about as long as anyone can remember Linux be existing, and even before then. And yesterday, actually, Jeremy, some of you might have seen the Golden Penguin Bowl. Did anybody see that? Yeah? All right.
Woo!
Jeremy's been hosting this for a little while, and we actually, Aaron and I, were invited to compete. We brought our friend Jeff Price along, and we had let's just call it our
you came
handed
second.
To us.
Yeah,
we came in second.
Yeah.
The Ubuntu
there
guys.
Good second.
With George over there. Actually,
we got our butts kicked, man.
Yeah.
They slaughtered
this
us.
This may be true, but, you know, if I ever need a bridge building, I know who I'm coming to.
Exactly.
Okay?
So Jeremy comes out on stage, though. He's been hosting this thing for a little while. He comes out on stage wearing a full astronaut suit as he walks out on stage doing his march out there in low gravity. It was
fantastic.
It was quite brilliant. And so Jeremy's something of an open source celebrity.
Yeah. So actually, just to start off, how did that whole Penguin Bowl thing start?
Well, actually, it first started one of the earliest Linux worlds. This was in New York.
Stop there. Earliest, yeah. Linux world.
God, I can't remember. When did Linux world start? I've been to every one of them, so I can't.
You can't remember anymore, can you?
Crispy says 99.
I'll believe that. I'll believe that. So it was 99 in New York, and I was a contestant because it was Nick Petrelli ran it, and he wrote the quiz, put all the questions together, and I know Nick, and he asked me to be a contestant. And it was basically sort of sci-fi geek type questions. And so I was on one team, and Eric Raymond was on the other team.
Everybody loves Eric Raymond.
Indeed, they do. And unfortunately, I had the immense misfortune to have on my team, and I'm not going to name names.
Go on, name names. This doesn't get out there broadcasted or podcasted. I think. Yeah,
I mean, nobody listens to this anyway.
And we can edit it out. It's cool.
I don't remember his name, but he is a friend of Richard Stallman. Okay, so he thought it would be really funny to shout out random answers for any of the questions that he felt like. So basically, there's Eric and I trying to run a serious quiz show, and Eric's good, right? I mean, Eric knows his science fiction robot Star Trek trivia, but so do
Unlike
I.
Us.
So we're at it, hammer and tongs, you see. And then this guy just keeps shouting out random crap, losing me points. I just wanted to deck him, you know?
I felt the same way with Ted yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, as I recall, you guys were doing pretty well not answering questions at the beginning, anyway. I really enjoyed that, and I did a couple of others. In fact,
Did you win or lose?
I lost.
Okay.
I ended up with a penguin. They gave me a consolation penguin, because if they'd actually totaled up the points without the negatives from this guy, I'd won. But basically, this guy ended up with us being like minus 20,000 or something. So it was just, so that I have the only penguin that's actually marked sort of, you know, best runner-up.
Worst performance ever.
Yeah, basically, worst score ever kind of penguin. And then, so Nick did it for a while, and I was on it occasionally, and I always went to see it. And then Chris DeBona took over when he was at VA. And I don't know whether you know this, but doing the penguin show is the most stressful part of my job. It doesn't look it. But because the problem is you have to write all the questions, you have to do all the GIMP work to do the jokes making fun of the corporations. And, you know, it's just an incredible amount of work. And so after a while, Chris burned out, and I don't blame him. And so he handed me this god-awful set of PHP scripts, which is the quiz show. And so I grabbed Jerry Carter, who's the Samba release manager, and Jerry always helps out on these things. And so we took over, and I just decided to make it a little more theatrical. So I've been trying to go for more and more outrageous costumes ever since. I started out with a game show host from hell costume, and it's been going... So after I did that one, Dan Fry from IBM came up to me, and because I was a little worried about the first one, because I kind of toned it down. I did a few sort of, let's just say, questionable questions about some of the corporations. And then Dan Fry came up to me and he said, "I'm really disappointed." I said, "Why? Didn't you like the show?" He said, "No, I loved it." He said, "But you didn't make fun of IBM." I'm like,
"You felt left out."
Oh, yeah, they felt left out. And at that point, I realized I can get up on stage there and I can say anything about anybody. And so I do.
And you did.
Yeah, I did. And you know, that's what really makes it fun, because it is fun. And so I've just been doing it ever since. But yeah, little stressful, but
let's get a little of your background now. You've been doing open source longer than Linux has been around. Is this correct?
Yeah. Back when I first started working on open source stuff, this was back in England. I first came across the GNU compiler toolchain, read the GPL license, recognized it instantly for what it was, which is socialism. that's what it is. I don't care what anyone thinks. And this was just really familiar. So I worked on it a while. I became the maintainer at one point for the position independent code patches for the Sun 386i, which, if anyone remembers, you kids get off my lawn, was an old 386 based Sun workstation, which Sun canned because it was faster than the Spark. And that was a real embarrassment at the time. Anyway, so I was the position independent code maintainer, and I sent a patch to Stallman. You know, I'd via UUCP, I think it was at the time, or whatever, routed it, sent a patch to Stallman, and I got a reply. You know? I got a reply.
They like me, they really do.
Yeah, they love. And it was like, you know, I don't know whether you guys read The Onion, but there's this, the classic Onion headline of all time is the one where it says, "God answers crippled child's prayer." And underneath it says, "No, says God." And it was kind of like that, because Stallman sent back, "Yeah, this is nice, but it's not generic enough, and I'm not putting it in. It sucks. Do it better." And it was like, "Oh my God, I got a reject message from Stallman. I'm blessed."
And it's still framed on your wall today, correct?
No. I junked that email years ago, along with the position independent code, which never got merged back in, of course, because in the end, I thought, screw this. It works for me. I'm not doing this for you, which is the traditional open source way. But yeah, I realized that, hey, I can do this. And that was, God, that was back in England, and that was probably 1888, 89, maybe.
Oh, yeah, I was graduating high school, I think, just a little bit before that.
Oh, yeah, you kids, yeah. You skateboard punks? Yeah.
Hey.
So, actually, I got to explain that real quick. So when I first met Jeremy, we're chatting and we're talking about different places we've been, and... the city of Nuremberg comes up, and we're like, "Oh yeah, Nuremberg, fantastic city," and we're going back and forth, yeah. And he mentions one of his favorite museums.
So I'd just been to Nuremberg, and for the first time I got some time to look around there, because Nuremberg is where Susie is based, and I went to the Nuremberg rally grounds, you know, the place where basically Hitler did all the speeches and whatever, and it's just this incredibly historic, creepy, kind of chilling place, the parade grounds, really quiet. You go around and you can actually stand on the podium where Hitler gave the speeches, and you're kind of looking at this, and in the background there's a bunch of skateboard punks beating the crap out of the concrete and just destroying the place.
And so as he's telling me about the museum, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's cool. I skated there when I was there.
Animal. I mean, this is a historic monument. I mean, this thing should be protected, you know.
And it's all marble and beautiful ledges. It's, you know, it's awesome.
And then there's these bunch of skateboard weenies just smashing the thing up. And it just, as a Brit, it offended me. You know, you know, and then as American, I'm thinking, you know, they should sell tickets.
So, to actually get on topic for a minute, can you just give us your perspective on Linux and open source?
Why are you doing it?
Why do I do it? Because it's fun. I don't give a crap about you guys. I don't care what you use it. I don't care if you use it. I do it because I like it. It's fun. You know? I get a full kernel. I've lived in the closed source world because there was no open source world. Actually, that's not true. When I first started, I started with an old British PC called the Acorn Atom with 2K of memory, 6502. And they gave you the operating system, because it was all burned into ROM, right? They gave you the operating system listing, and it was just a bunch of assembly code. But you could look through it, and you worked out how it worked. But that's how things were done. And then there was just this incredible amount of incredibly creative period in British history with all these micros. I mean, can you imagine, there was a time in England in the 80s when somebody tried to mass market a PC that ran Forth as a consumer device. I mean, looking back at it now, it's like, were they crazy? They went bust, of course. But so there was this incredible period of creativity. Then the IBM PC came out with DOS, and it just rolled over everything like a tank and just crushed the life out of it. It was miserable. And then at that point, it's like, oh, so we have DOS now. And yeah, okay, it's kind of standard, but how does it work? No source code, no listing, end user license prohibiting, you know, disassembly, et cetera, et cetera. And everything kind of closed down. And at that point, what you ended up with when you bought a computer was a black box that rattled when you shook it. So you knew something was broken inside, but you didn't know what it was, and there was no way to get inside it. And so at that point, actually, I decided, well, the only thing I can do, I'm going to have to get a job at somewhere where I can look inside. And so that's why I ended up getting a job eventually at Sun. So I had access to the source code for the operating system. So I was happy then. It's like, okay, I'm okay. You guys can go screw yourselves. You don't get the source, but I do, so that's okay. You know, but this is a little unfair, and, you know, my Sheffield roots, you know, rebelled against this. And so when Linux came out, actually, I was a Minix hacker originally. I used to mess around with the SCSI code on the Atari ST version of Minix. And then I saw Linus's announcement in the Minix group, because I used to subscribe to CompOS Minix. And I remember thinking, loser, that'll never go anywhere. You know, and I kind of ignored it, because there were lots of other similar things at the time. And then after a while, I think it was around Linux 1.10, it got networking. And at that point, it became interesting. Before then, it was a standalone PC, no networking support, whatever. It wasn't really that interesting, because I'd been living in the Sun world for a while. You know, and what you have to remember at that time is how far ahead the Sun networking environment was from anywhere else. You know, I mean, I remember going into a law firm and seeing them working on PCs with a... you know, I think they were using a LANMAN file server or whatever. And every so often, it's like everybody would just sit there. I'm like, what's the matter? Oh, well, the network's down. I'm like, oh, my God, why isn't somebody doing something? Oh, no, this happens about once a day. You know, and the Sun network, you know, and NetWare or whatever, it never goes down. You know, it just... A network downtime is an outrage. You know, I moved from Manchester, the Manchester Sun office, to California, and my home directory was mounted. And you expected that. That's just the way things were. And then all of a sudden, you get this environment that is just crippled and broken. And, you know, and the worst thing about sort of the PC environment until Linux came along was that people thought that that's the way it was. That's the way that computers were. They were just unreliable and broken, you know? And so Linux came along. Once it started to get networking, at that point, the black box was open again. And you can look inside and you can play with stuff. So, I mean, that's why I do it, because I can look inside, and if something bugs me, I get to fix it. You know, and I have. You know, I finally started messing around with the SIFS code in the Linux kernel, and, you know, it didn't do locking right, so I fixed it. It now does locking right. You know, it's that level of control that it gives you.
We're speaking with Jeremy Allison, who is the maintainer of the Samba project for our podcast, Novell Open Audio. And if anybody would like to join in on some seats, we'll be taking questions from the audience in just a moment. But, Jeremy, we've had you on the show once before. We went into a little bit of your work on the Samba project. And when we interviewed you that time, you told us a little bit about the story of why you came to Novell. And so people can listen to that episode to find out the why. But tell us a little bit about the transition you made when you moved from, because you were working, I believe, at HP prior to, you moved here, and what are the big changes that happened when you started working in a company that actually does a Linux distribution?
Well, the biggest change, the best change, nothing to do with the company. They let me work from home all the time. Let me tell you, when you work from home, clothing becomes optional. You know?
I really didn't need that.
Those of you who are listening to this as the recorded podcast, be thankful.
I am wearing a Novell shirt. I must point that out right now.
Jeremy is 100% fully dressed.
I am fully
clothed. Aaron is almost.
But, you know, you can get a sock puppet and put it in front of the webcam for any conferences and stuff. But my commute, I used to have to fight 101 and 85 and whatever. My commute now is walking from the kitchen to my office, you know, with a cup of coffee. I never want to work in an office again. You know, I've done the cube farm thing. It's just, working at home is just marvelous. I must admit, I do tend to get given free hardware, which is not usual, I know that. But I have a gigabit network set up. You know, admittedly, I only have DSL, but I have everything I need there.
So you have all this iron in your home now, and that causes, I'm sure, no amount of domestic strife at all.
Oh, no. My wife finds it absolutely perfectly acceptable to have broken down pieces of computers strewn all over the kitchen, and I never have problems with that. so I try and keep it out of the way, at least in one of the bedrooms, which I've colonized. So I do try and keep that out of the way. But it's just, working for a Linux distribution company people care. You know, it's not about selling the iron, it's about making solutions work. You know, and admittedly, that sometimes means I get dragged on site to fix people's stuff, which really sucks. So if you have a problem, never ask me. essentially, making this stuff work is our business. It has to work. So the other thing I noticed is I work 10 times harder than I used to.
Good.
And I get people calling me all hours of the day and night, you know? So that, but you know something? I actually like that. Not the calling all hours of the day and night part, but actually knowing people use it, people care about it. You know, I won't say there's a warm and fuzzy feeling when somebody files a bug saying your code sucks, but at least it knows that somebody's actually trying to use it. And that makes a hell of a difference.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the people you work with? I mean, I've met some of the people on your team, and they've just blown me away.
Yeah, basically the team is virtual. So the people within Novell I work with mainly are Lars Mueller and Gunther Deschner. Gunther works virtually out of home, he's in Berlin. Lars basically is, I don't know whether he's one of the longest SUSE people, but he's been there a very long time in Nuremberg, and he knows everybody. And basically those guys, I think you have an interview in the can with Lars already, don't you?
Yeah, we have an interview with Lars coming up where Lars actually explains what he does. But Lars is the person, and actually he's here, he's around the corner, you can't miss him. He's a huge, tall,
yeah, he's
German
a really tall,
redhead.
Redheaded guy.
Yeah.
And he's really funny. You know, you don't associate Germans with humor, but...
Well,
but Lars is a really funny guy.
They've gotten together in this one individual.
Yeah, Lars is a really funny guy. And he's a great lecturer. I think, I don't know whether he's done his talk yet, but he and Gunther are giving a talk. And essentially, they've been the architects of a lot of the work that has gone in to make the SUSE Linux desktop integrate seamlessly into a Windows environment.
We're talking authentication, being able to authenticate to your Kerberos server, and then having single sign-on to everything. It's
basically downloading some of the group policy information, and obeying the password policies, that kind of thing. They've just done an absolutely stellar job of that. And so Gunther really is in the Samba tree. He's the Windbind maintainer. Lars, if you notice, whenever Jerry does a release of Samba, it's like 3 minutes later, Lars has the SUSE binaries up and ready. I mean, they just work really, really well together as a team.
And actually, I do want to mention one thing about Lars that blew me away. You know, Ted and I get to deal with a lot of developers. And one of the things that's weird with dealing with developers sometimes is giving them suggestions about things that need to be changed. So we're over in Germany. Lars, we had just met him minutes ago. He's showing us all this cool code that he put into Sled and how we can do all these neat things. And Ted's looking over his shoulder, and he looks, and what was it?
It was the default name for the network, for the workgroup network, for Windows shares or whatever, is tux-net inside of Samba. And we looked at that, and we said, well, that's cute, and you know, it uses the name Tux and everything, but if you really want to drop these things into a Linux environment or a Windows environment, it's got to be the default name, and it should be workgroup.
And what's so neat is we mentioned that to Lars, and he was like, oh, he alt-tabbed out, changed the code, and saved it. And he was like, okay, it's done. Yeah. It was just so cool not to fight with him that, I mean, you can give him...
Developers are obstinate. Yeah. They don't make the changes when you ask them to immediately until you really lay out the case.
Yeah.
He just did it.
Yeah, like me, I'd have told you to go.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Jeremy made a friendly gesture when he waved at me. We do, as many of you know who are listeners of Novell Open Audio regularly on the podcast, we post up before we do an interview who's going on to be on the show, what the subject is, and we then take questions by phone or take questions by our voicemail or take questions by email, and we send out to people the famous T-shirt now here seen in action, the I Ask Tough Questions T-shirt. Jeremy Allison is here in front of you. Do we have anybody? And I think the gentleman in the back here has already put in a bid for a question. So do you have a question back there? We'll bring a microphone around to you.
Yes, the original question was going to be, Jeremy, what'd you do with the spacesuit? But you kind of went into that a little bit.
I will take it back to the rental shop tomorrow.
And do we have other questions for Jeremy?
I've got a kind of a Samba question. May or may not even be related to Samba, but I noticed with just recently SMBFS support being removed and it's replaced with CIFS. And are you seeing that as pretty much SMBFS going to go away and everything's going to be CIFS from now on?
Yep, it's a done deal. Okay. Basically, the SMBFS code in the Linux kernel doesn't have a maintainer. Unmaintained code is broken code. SIFSFS is basically the replacement for SMBFS. There's no one in the Samba team or community who is maintaining SMBFS. I think Volker Lendecki, a German Samba team member, originally wrote SMBFS. It was adopted by someone into the Linux kernel, but they stopped maintaining it. And Volker's too busy to pick that back up again. So Steve French at IBM started writing the SIFSFS client, and essentially what we'd like you to do is, if you find cases where SMBFS works, SIFSFS doesn't, file bugs, because they'll get fixed.
Sounds good.
SIFSFS will be changed to do Kerberos authentication. It's the long-term solution. It's the maintained solution that's moving forward in the Linux kernel. We're even making it work with OS2. I don't know. I kind of like charity work. It's just...
Not really a question, but can you talk about Samba 4 a little bit and what we can expect from Samba 4 in the future?
All right. So Samba 4 is basically the research arm of the Samba project. So Samba 4 right now is a bunch of experimental code and technologies trying to work out what we need to do to have an Active Directory domain controller. So some of the Samba code will make it into production releases. In fact, a lot of it already has. The next step that we're going to do is backport a lot of the interface definition language and remote procedure call stuff into the production code base. And essentially, as we work out how things work in Samba 4, things get moved back into the production release. And so my what I always say about that is whenever we do an Active Directory domain controller fully, that code will call Samba 4. I don't know what that code will look like right now and how much of a merge between the current experimental branch and the production branch it'll be somewhere in the middle. I don't know. But when it's done, Samba 4 is a Samba is an Active Directory domain controller will be called Samba 4.
We'll take another one.
Not quite as serious, but yesterday with Tron, they didn't get the bonus question.
Oh, yeah, the bonus. I love the bonus question. The bonus question, so the question that people got wrong was how many minutes were computer generated in Tron? And I almost cut down I had four choices. It was actually like 15 minutes. And the bonus question was, I don't know whether you remember Tron, but do you remember the Dillinger, the evil CEO? The question was, it was a picture of Dillinger as a hint for people to, you know, people to have, not that the hint seemed to do any good, but...
I was very young then.
Yes, he was very young. He you probably played the video game, right?
Yes.
So there was a picture of Dillinger, and the question was, what user input peripheral first seen in Tron has now actually become a USB device? Can you answer that? Picture of Dillinger as a hint. The keyboard, indeed. You would have got the 250-point bonus. There is now a virtual keyboard that projects out as light onto any flat surface. And I remember seeing Tron back in the day and being incredibly impressed by the fact that Dillinger's had this black marble desk and things just appeared on it. So pictures appeared, you know, video appeared, you know, and then a keyboard appeared when he wanted to type anything. And this was just so cool. Not computer-generated, but still pretty cool. So...
I think we have time for one other question. Did you have one back there? Yep. All right.
Hi. This might be related to Samba. I was playing with SQLite, and then they said NFS doesn't have proper POSIX locking. Does Samba or CIFS have proper POSIX locking?
Okay. So this is a really interesting one. NFS actually does have POSIX locking, but it sucks and is usually broken.
But you're more than welcome to use it.
Yeah, and people do, but the semantics are poor. Now, Samba 3.023, which we just shipped, has... what we've done is we've extended the SIFS protocol, and the 3.023 release has support for POSIX locking in Samba over SIFS. And it is complete POSIX semantics, exactly correct. But it only works between SMBDs on the same box. So in other words, if you're running a local process and you get a POSIX lock, the SMBD process won't see that. Now, for 3.024, because I spent a lot of time doing this code recently, and in fact, the great thing about it was I threw out more code than I added. You always know when you've got a design right when you throw out more code than you add. So in 3.024, it maps those POSIX locks directly onto the file system. So you have a completely unified lock space. Everybody sees everybody else's byte range locks, and they have complete POSIX semantics. You can lock upgrade, downgrade, you can split, merge, the whole deal. And then I went back, because this code wasn't in the SIFS-FS client, I went back, and that when I said I fixed locking in SIFS-FS, that was the piece that I did. So I don't think that's in any release code. It will be in the next release kernel. So to get the full effect, you'll need an as-yet-unreleased kernel and an as-yet-unreleased Samba. But if you want to play, you can check this code out as the version. And then the nice thing about the SIFS-FS code for the Linux kernel is there's two versions. There's a leading-edge kernel version that goes into the Git tree that Linus runs, and then there's a separate subversion repository off the Samba site that Steve French runs that he and I work on that is the SIFS-FS code backported to all the old kernels or down to 2.6. Something or whatever. And so you can check that code out individually and you can build it for whatever kernel you have and you can use that as a replacement for the SIFS-FS that ships with the actual kernel.
I have one final question. Have you answered ever yes or no to a question? Just like simple and short?
This is a yes or no question.
No, I haven't. I always say, hey, aren't you going to answer
that? Thank you very much. This has been Jeremy Allison on Novell Open Audio.
He wants the last.
Well,
Oh, you want that question? You want that one question? You want that question?
I wanted to make that point. That's a great question.
I don't have the paper anymore.
Give me your paper.
Can you ask the question yourself?
Give me this question. I get all set up to answer it, and they don't ask.
Here is the question that we did not ask on our sheet because we tried to just be adaptive during the show, but apparently Jeremy has to have this opportunity to talk.
I'm telling you, podcasts is radio for people living in their parents' basements. It really is. I don't know.
Here is the question. We're only this far from Wayne's World. We get asked this all the time. I'm going to read it like this,
too.
I'm going to read it like bad Hollywood.
Read it slowly and move your finger along as you do.
We get asked this all the time. Novell has always had an alternative to doing Windows shares. Of course, we call that NetWare.
NetWare, yeah.
And does now having the maintainer of Samba at Novell signify that Novell has surrendered to the dominance of Windows?
But this is a great question because it makes absolutely no sense. Because look back at NetWare. What does the NetWare client run on?
Windows.
Windows, right? So if you're going to complain about surrendering to the dominance of Windows, you're moving from something that only ever ran on Windows to Linux, right? And so that's surrendering to the dominance of Windows. You guys... get off my lawn. Get alive. And put that skateboard down.
Ladies and gentlemen, Novell Open Audio is a production of Novell Users International in conjunction with Novell Incorporated. Our content that's on the show is largely directed by our listening community, so you can send email to us, openaudio@novell.com, request for subjects that you want to hear on Novell Open Audio. You can find us at novell.com/openaudio. You can rate any show that you've heard there, including this one. It'll be online, hopefully tonight. And you can also leave comments on any show there. Your hosts, Aaron Quill, Ted Hager, we really thank you for joining us here.
And I do want to point out the views expressed by Jeremy were his views only and not...
not the views of Novell Corporation.
The Novell Corporation, the United States, or England.
Or the Indeed. Thanks very much, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Thanks a lot.